Within the deepest recesses of the darkest corners, in the dingiest of libraries, on refectory tables, within dens of debauchery, places of erudition, libraries, bookstores, bedrooms, living rooms, motel rooms, majestic halls illuminated by dim light bulbs, these 21 lip blockers did read again. Five nominees, 21 lip blockers, the Lit Blog Co-op.
Five
nominees and a blackjack to peruse their innards. Ladies and gentlemen, readers of all deviant persuasions, including vanilla, please join us as we momentarily preempt Mr. Segundo the next round of the LBC Podcast. So I am here with the lovely Tangerine Mumu herself, Carrie A.A. Fry, who nominated Yannick Murphy's Here They Come. Carrie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thinking of tangerines right now for some damn reason. But tell me about this Murphy book and why you nominated it. What was it that sort of like, you know, made it stick out, so to speak?
Well, I read it right before it was time for me to put in my nomination, and I loved it. Stayed up all night reading it. I think what I loved about it is the voice of the narrator. It's a young girl, I think she's 13. We never get her name, and she's growing up in New York in the 70s, and she's part of this big family. She's got a brother who runs around in a silk robe and a couple sisters, and her father has just left her mother, so they're always without money. And I really loved her voice. She reminded me a lot of Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird or Dido Twight. Like, there's this great tradition of semi-feral young girls mm-hmm. who are very observant. Mm-hmm. And she felt to me like that.
Was it the sort of poverty that kind of drew you into the book, or the specific surrealistic imagery? We don't know how much
of
it is.
I think what I loved is the familiness. I've been telling friends I've been recommending the book to. Do you know the book I Capture the Castle by Dodi Smith?
I wish I did. I don't, unfortunately.
It's a wonderful book, and it's got a lot of admirers. And it's the same thing of a family living in penury, but yet still being creative within it. And to me, this is like but I Capture the Castle is England, I think, in the 20s or something.
Uh-huh.
And this seemed to me like a demented I Capture the Castle. The pleasures of it are the same, that there's this young female coming to life, but it's as much about her and her family, and all the people around her are just as interesting to observe as she is.
So for you, the book was largely kind of the narrator's voice that was the
yes.
thing that kind of drew.
Yes, I loved her lines.
Okay. Is it? Do you think that a book needs to have a really sort of solid narrator behind it in order to work, or?
Definitely not. I think for first person,
yeah.
it obviously helps. I think also to lure someone in to have the kind of voice that jumps off the page
mm-hmm.
Is more entrancing. I don't really know, Ed.
That's okay. I don't really know much of anything either, so. Carrie, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Bye.
I am here with Yannick Murphy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Ed. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. So anyway, I wanted to talk about what we were talking about last time, which was the notion of Here They Come being actually far more autobiographical in its way than I anticipated. And maybe you can talk about what elements you sort of took from your own life and the sort of divide between imagination and biography, perhaps.
Okay, well, you know, the setting is pretty true to life. That's mm-hmm. Where I grew up in New York, and the people in the novel are also the people who I grew up with, my brother and two sisters and my mother, and my parents were divorced, so that is all true to form there. the events, most of the events are true, and the only thing is that I ended up writing the book so that it takes place over the course of a year. But really, all those events that happened in my life probably took place between the ages of 11 and, who knows, 16 or 17, something like that.
And you also learned how to bend spoons with your mind, presumably. I didn't actually get into that subject last time. But
oh, yeah, okay. Everybody wants to know about the mind-bending spoons. Okay, well, when I was a kid, I was watching a program with my mother, and it was about Uri Geller was the guest, and he was some psychic. And anyway, he got in front of the audience and said, you know, you can do it too. Just set your mind on it, and you can bend a spoon. And so for some reason, I was able to do that, and it was probably only that day and that hour at that time, and the stars were aligned, and that was it. But that ended up in the book, and you, among other people, are fascinated by it.
Well, it's not every day that you come across someone who can bend spoons with their minds.
No, I'll never be able to do it again. So.
Well, I also wanted to talk about, maybe you can talk about the process of writing this book that you had described, not just to me, but also to other interviewers, that you had written the book, or at least the germination of the book came in one night. Now, maybe you can talk about how you sort of came to write the book, how it came along, how you structured it, etc.
Well, I had never thought of writing this book so autobiographically before. A lot of my stories and my other work and my other novels, there's always a kernel of me in them, and that's usually the diving board for me, the jumping board, where I start a story or just include a bit of my life in there. But with this book, it was a sleepless night, and I started thinking, you know, I could really write a book about the way I grew up. And the more I started thinking about it, the more sleep was definitely out of the question, and all of these events that occur in the book started coming to my brain, and I thought, you know what, I better write these down. But of course, my husband asleep next to me wouldn't have appreciated me getting up in the middle of the night, and my computer was in our bedroom, and he wouldn't have appreciated me turning the light on and getting to work on the computer. So I had to kind of hold it in the whole night and see how much I could recall when I sat down to the keys the next morning and started typing it all in. And it really came in a rush, because there were things I just did not want to forget, and I was sort of tripping over myself, trying to get it all down. And it, in a way, it was providential, because I like the way that the novel ends up having that kind of pressure behind it. You know, I can almost sense that it's got this forward momentum to it, and I really like that quality of the book, and I don't think it's something I would have been able to have dreamt up except if the circumstances had been the way they were.
Well, aside from the wave of inspiration, what steps did you take to kind of keep things fresh, or to keep the momentum that you're describing up? And also, even if the computer was off, why didn't you grab a notebook? Did you do that, or?
God forbid, then I would think that I would kill the moment. I don't know. You know, I really just thought that that I would fall asleep, and that, you know, I'd remember the three things I had remembered, but as time kept going by, there were just more things to remember, and it was almost a challenge in the morning to get up and do it and keep, remember what I had written down. But the actual story itself, it came because I just was interested in writing from the perspective of a girl that young. It's really interesting to me to write a story or any piece of writing from someone who's that age, because they're not fully aware, at least I wasn't fully aware, of everything that I saw and how it was affecting me. And it enabled me to really kind of have this narrator kind of transform the reader instead of inform the reader, in a sense that you got to see everything that she witnessed, and as her, whatever she saw and whatever she let come to the surface in her heart, which at the time she wasn't aware of what she was feeling. So the effect is very visual instead of something that you get to learn about this narrator's feelings so much, which I don't think is what a girl who's 13 years old, which is what the character is in this book, could really report on anyway.
Well, we also were kind of mentioning the sort of closeness between the surreal environment of the trash-strewn apartment. You know, it's not necessarily as invented as one might actually think.
No, that's right.
And maybe you can sort of elaborate on this and how this pertains to what you're describing here with the protagonist kind of coming to terms, the unnamed protagonist coming to terms here with the situation.
Well, you know, growing up in New York in the 70s was a difficult period. I had a commercial loft. That's what I lived in, and commercial loft at the time didn't have any garbage removal service, and so either you paid for it or you just went out on the street corner every night with your bag of garbage and, you know, hopefully put it in there without anyone noticing or reporting you. Well, it turned out that we would do that for, well, we did do it for a couple of months, and then all of a sudden we were fined because, I don't know, one of us must have been careless and left an envelope in the trash with our address on it. And so the fine was, I don't know, for that time and day, it was a lot of money. So we stopped doing that. and the garbage had to pile up in the house until someone who was a friend of the family was able to lend us their car or take us to the dump. And we would pile all the garbage in there, and it made for, you know, a smelly house at certain times of the month, especially certain times of the year when it was unbearably hot.
Were there as many pets growing up too? I didn't ask that last time, but I was curious. I mean, it was very, very close what you described, and the whole presence of animals and things like that.
Yeah, you know, we did for some reason have a lot of animals. We had at the time that the book takes place, we had a dog, a German Shepherd, and we had we had cats, three cats, one for each girl in the family owned a cat, and then my sister owned mice, and we had guinea pigs. I don't even think the guinea pigs are in the book, but we had birds. We had parrots at one point. And we just liked animals, and we still do.
Well, I was going to ask you actually about sort of the resilience of a child's imagination, and how much this notion, like something similar to like Mitch Collins' Tideland, where it's sort of about a child kind of overcoming adversity in the face of a really sort of terrible environment. And I'm wondering how much of this theme that has reverberated throughout the course of fiction, how much this might have been on your mind as you were writing the book.
You know, I must have been in some kind of trance when I wrote this book, because I wasn't fully aware of making sure that I was within the limits of the 13-year-old. I mean, I knew that when I wanted to write the book that it was interesting to me to write from that perspective, but that was enough for me, you know, to write the first sentence knowing that, and the rest just followed one sentence after the other. You know, it was definitely going to be in that, it was going to have that stance and that point of view, and that was pretty much locked in there based on the first sentence.
Now, I should also note that the hot dog vendor is also real, and I'm wondering if you can, I guess what I want to sort of get from you is to see how much invention was applied in the course of remembering these details, and what you did to sort of kind of keep everything sort of legitimately fictive.
Well, you know, John the Hot Dog Man was a real person, and apart from me just making up certain scenes, he definitely was a character in my life. I would go to visit him simply out of sheer boredom for being a kid who didn't have much to do at home, or because I was lonely and he was, you know, a provider of food, definitely free food. And did I see him as much as I did in the book? No. In the book, I definitely added more scenes because he helped portray what this 13-year-old was like, and I needed him as a source of like a reflection, so that you can find out what the character was like a little more deeply.
Well, I mean, how much of the protagonist's voice in these encounters, for example, with John, is sort of designed as a coping mechanism, as designed as a way of coming to terms with reality? I guess I sort of phrased my question a little poorly there, but maybe you can, I guess, the voice as catharsis within the actual novel, you know, within her own particular situation.
I'm thinking that the question was that why did she use him to cope? And
I'm sorry. I totally misstated. What I meant to suggest was, let's go back to square one.
Okay.
So, okay, you have such details as John the hot dog vendor who are imagined. You have terms of reference such as, like, you know, the father's girlfriend, and I'm wondering how much of these stylistic devices and even the characters are intended as a sort of coping mechanism. The lack of bullshit, the way that all these details are presented is in a very sort of distinctive and stylized voice. And I'm wondering how much of this did you tap upon to sort of get inside the protagonist's way of coping with this really sort of terrible situation?
Well, that's true. There were certain moments where I knew that this protagonist would have to cope with certain things. So she would imagine certain things that were going on between characters. For example, the brother and the slut when they go up to Spain together. There was no way for me to know what they were doing if they went off together. So I imagined it, and that's what I imagine a 13-year-old would do, just in order to cope, in order to justify why all of these traumatic things are happening around her. She has to understand that the hot dog man, at the same time, she's old enough to know that when he gropes her, that in return she can get something from it, whether it be the companionship, whether it be the free Hershey's chocolate bar.
But it's not just about the incentive, it's also about how she refers to the world around her. It's about the sort of, you know, referencing the father's girlfriend as the slut. And names in this book sort of mean something, and one might make the claim that this is kind of a way for her to kind of cope with the situation, this kind of imagined life that she sort of styled for herself. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, it's definitely easier for her just to name these things, to call the woman the slut, and therefore she won't have to be close enough to her to really feel bad about the situation, because she's given her this distancing name.
But I guess, though, I mean, was the motivation behind coming up with these names, I'm wondering where it stemmed from. Did it stem from your own sort of autobiography, so to speak, your old autobiographical details?
I wouldn't have put it past my sisters and I to have used that word at that time in our lives for this woman.
Well, I guess what was the inspiration behind the naming of all these various people and the points of reference, the specific, you know, descriptive words you use, not just slut, but also, like, you know, I know that merit is pulled from reality, but maybe you can talk about the line between what is, you know, kind of taken from your own life and what is taken within the reality of the novel that you've structured.
Well, I think that if you knew me better, you'd probably not be surprised by me using the word, oh, the slut or the hot dog man, or, you know, just it's an easy way for me to reference people. So a lot of that is just my personality showing mm-hmm. through, and it wasn't an intentional kind of, well, that's definitely why I'm going to reference that person with that word or use that word to describe them.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the journey into Spain and how this kind of, it takes the sort of book out of the kind of hard New York sort of environment, and we're now in something a little bit sunnier, but we're also away from the perspective of the protagonist. How did this arise? Why did it sort of feel right? That kind of thing.
Well, it definitely felt right because in the book, the first, I don't know how many pages it is until we get to that scene, but there's a lot of pages, and it's all in New York City, and all of a sudden I felt like, you know, this needs a bit of fresh air. This needs a new place for the characters to go to, and it made sense because the character, the father character, was missing, and where did he go? Well, if you were a 13-year-old and your father was missing and you heard no phone calls from him or anything, you may begin to believe, well, he could be anywhere. He could be in Spain. And so it seemed logical that this is the place that they would go to search for him, the brother and the slut. And it once I started writing it, I was maybe the first line when I realized, wow, these people are going to Spain. I was a little nervous. A lot nervous, really, because you are changing the perspective of the piece. You are bringing it out into another world, and are you being truthful to the pages that you've written beforehand? Does it work? And, you know, I took the plunge. I jumped in, and I said, you know what, it just feels right. It makes sense that this character would imagine all of this going on in order to protect herself, in order to justify to herself that this is why my father's not here.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also imagery is very explicit throughout the course of this book. There are very specific sort of details, and there are other details that are perhaps not so specific. And I was wondering if you had a particular rule for why you would describe, like, for example, the hot dog man's scarves flying like, you know, waddles by their chins as they push and push their way up the avenue, or the scar, things like these, or even like the blood poisoning. Sometimes you have the protagonist a bit removed, and sometimes you don't. So what kind of rules or what kind of instinct did you operate by when you were devising?
Well, that's the right word, instinct, because I definitely did do all of that by instinct. It just, you know, when I saw the image of the hot dog man walking down the street, I realized it's not just going to be one short word to describe that. There's a couple more things I need to tell the reader exactly how they looked, because it was a kind of a window into what the narrator was like. You know, the things that she chose to see is how you learn about her personality, rather than the conversations you may have with people or any kind of, you know, self kind of realization about herself or any kind of things she may say that are emotional.
You refer to her mother as our mother instead of my mother. I didn't ask you this last time, but I wanted to this suggests one of two possibilities. Either she sort of is very kind of trying to find a sort of a family kind of unit within this sort of hell, or there are possibly sort of two varying personalities, or possibly the brother and the brother's trip to Spain perhaps falls within the kind of sort of view or within the scope of the particular novel. I was wondering if you could talk about that. Why did our mother kind of crop up instead of my mother?
Well, our mother was definitely more to convey that this is a family unit.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happens doesn't just happen to her, and that makes it easier for her to cope. It happens to the whole family. She sees it as her sisters, her brother, this is happening to us. And it was just a way of kind of thinning out the terror that she's facing, and also giving you a sense of closeness, that as a reader you can get close to her because she's the type of person that will include you in everything. She doesn't know particularly where the story is going or what journey she's going to take, but as long as you're there with her doing it, then she can keep going and have the momentum to find out what's going to happen at the end. And so it's kind of for the sake of having an accomplice.
Now, you are a New Yorker who has escaped to California, I should note. And I wanted to sort of ask you, because this subject kind of came up with Gina Frangello, where she wrote this book about Chicago and Amsterdam, and here you wrote this book about New York and California. Did you feel that the kind of separation of distance kind of aided you in kind of coming to writing this book? Or
yeah, definitely. I wouldn't have been able to have written this book while living in New York. I'm sure that the distance always makes the events more romantic, and I'm able to pinpoint more clearly things that happened. Whereas if I were living in New York, I'd probably see a hot dog man and say, oh, no, I can't write about a hot dog man. You know, look, it is like the cart's got four wheels, and, you know, I imagined it had three or something ridiculous like that. You know, there would be too many things that were so true that I would have been thwarted in my creativity about the whole thing.
So in your view, it's probably best, at least when you write fiction, to kind of have a certain kind of distance so that you don't have to check the details, that you can, this is actually better for the imagination and better for the memory and better for the in the actual process.
It's better for me just because if I know everything precisely, then I'm not engaged enough to continue writing it. I need to be entertained just as much as you are. If my doesn't, you know, the ideas of my writing and the actual writing doesn't keep me up at night, then why should it keep you, the reader, up at night reading it?
Do you feel that you must sort of abdicate more to imagination rather than, you know, some people are particularly sort of obsessive in their details, like Nicholson Baker is the author that sort of comes to mind. But you feel that fiction that a fiction writer working today must be aided and abetted by her own imagination rather than, you know, sort of transposing, which we see a lot of actually in contemporary fiction.
Right. Well, you know, what works for me works for me. It's I don't know what other people do. Well, you know, obviously I've read interviews of other famous writers, but what worked for me is to let some part of my psyche take over so that I'm not, if someone came up and asked me a question behind me, I wouldn't really hear them because part of me is at work that isn't at work when I'm dealing with people in a normal day-to-day situation. And I like that. I let that come out on the page.
We were chatting last time about the A&P and the whole shift from them being a sort of benevolent mom-and-pop operation to them being more of a sort of corporate kind of, you know, not-so-sympathetic. At first, we see them, you know, handing out a few things to the poor, some leftover stock, and then the actual A&P totally transforms within the course of the book. And I had posited that this was kind of a reflection of the inevitable sort of slide from the 1970s into Reaganomics. And I guess I wanted to sort of, I'm going to phrase the question better than I did last time and ask you a little bit more specifically about how the environment affects sort of these kinds of social values that you sort of, you know, that the protagonist experiences and Here They Come.
Well, it was definitely a consideration because here she's growing up, you know, a year passes or so, and the more that this harsh reality sets in, so too, you know, the fact that the stores changed, so too does the harsh reality set in that she's, you know, she's got trouble on her hands. She's got people who don't care about her so much in her eyes.
Okay. Was there any kind of, when you were revising this book at any point down the line, did you kind of think in terms of sort of, I guess, ethical sort of shifts in character or things like that that we kind of see throughout the book, the troubled nature of the brother, for example, or anything like that?
You know, I think that because this is so much of it is autobiographical, I tried not to think about anything ethical and tried to put all of that out of my head for the sake of writing the book and having it sound as fresh and new as it could be. And I wanted it to sound like something that no one else had ever written before. And so for the sake of that, I didn't question ethics.
You just wanted to present what you kind of remembered and what you devised. Now, I will go ahead and sort of offer a kind of a two-parter to this. And that is, again, was there any part of this novel that was like in which you completely capitulated to imagination completely?
Well, you know, the part where they go to Spain—that's definitely imagined. Mm-hmm. That character In real life, that's not what happened to my father. That's not what happened to my brother and the slut. So all of that was imagined through this narrator's eyes, through her imagination. Things that were totally imagined, I don't know. I mean, there's probably certain images in there that were imagined just because I had to go back and search my memory and say, okay, what exactly did this character, Manolo, for example, look like? And since my memory, I wasn't exactly sure what I wrote down was imagined in certain at certain places, and things he may have said were imagined.
Okay. Now, I wanted to talk about working with Eli Horowitz at McSweeney's, who has published this book and published The People of Paper and has offered, I think, an interesting shift in the books coming out by McSweeney's. What input did Eli give you? How was your working relationship with him?
Well, it was great. Eli is really wonderful because he's not a text editor who sits down and crosses a single word out and says, change this and do this and do that. He'll make notes, but he'll mostly talk to you about something. He'll say, I kind of wanted to get to know the brother character a little better. And the way I would work with Eli would be, okay, don't say anymore. I want to go in and see exactly where I can flesh it out and find a place where you will be able to see the brother in a better light so that you'll know who he is in a better fashion. So it was kind of that, less is more critique that he would give me, and definitely there were times that I would go through the writing again, and he may not have marked anything or had mentioned anything about a particular scene, but I went through it again just because I was able to and ended up liking the changes that I made. So really, to write the book was almost as much fun as to work with Eli on the edits, because lots of new things came up that weren't there in the original that I had fun with. I mean, not major things, but little scenes and just turns of phrases and things like that that I found just much more exciting. The ending, we played with that a little bit, and I really like the ending now better than the original version that Eli saw when my agent first presented it to him.
Now, was Eli, would you say, was he more of a conceptual editor rather than a sort of hard-line editor? I mean, it seems that he was communicating to you more through conversations than through sort of like, shuffling paper.
Well, that's true. He there definitely, when the book was in a more solid form, we would have to go through it and do the line edits, too. So it wasn't as if he didn't go through the line edits. It was just something that he wasn't going to present to me from the get-go.
Gotcha. Thanks very much, Yannick. Great, a pleasure talking with you, and happy Mother's Day.
Thanks.